or never. That is the word from President Trump to Republicans on the plan to repeal Obamacare.
I spoke to the president, and I told him that the best thing I think to do is to pull this bill, and he agreed with that decision.
That the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now. And I think the losers are Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, because now they own Obamacare. They own it, 100% own it.
Today, a victory for the Affordable Care Act. That was the spirit in which we came into this debate, honoring the vows of our founders of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a healthy life, the liberty to pursue our happiness.
Actually, I think we were probably doing the Democrats a favor by passing this law before it gets even worse. Well, I guess that favor is not going to be given to them, and it's going to get worse.
No, I think we have to let Obamacare go its way for a little while, and we'll see how things go. I'd love to see it do well, but it can't. I mean, it can't. It's not a question of, gee, I hope it does well. I would love it to do well. I want great health care for the people of this nation, but it can't do well. It's imploding, and soon will explode.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, stocks having another negative week as the correction continues. Markets are down for the week. We have a big debate going on in Congress on the passage of health care. Will they pass it and repeal Obamacare? That's still being debated. I guess we'll know at the end of the day. But we have a little bit of the risk-off trade as utility average was the only positive index for the week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Dan Rutrobsky will be joining us. He says, you know what? He sees a pullback in market breadth in some of the momentum, so it's likely that we're seeing a pullback in the market. He doesn't expect it to be big, but nonetheless, the momentum and market breadth indicators are weakening. He believes we're moving into a reflationary cycle, and wait till you hear what he has to say about where interest rates are heading. He'll be joining me in the first hour. Ned Schmidt will also be joining us as we take a look at the ag sector in commodities. The ag stocks have been doing much better than the commodities. What does that mean? And guess what, folks? We have a shortage of pork and maybe a possibility of a shortage of chickens here. Is this bird flu as they kill hundreds of thousands of chickens? We'll talk about that, the implications for investing in the ag sector with Ned Schmidt. And then, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
Listen, if there's a shortage in pork, the one people you don't want to know about that is the politicians, okay? Just keep it from them. Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. And on today's Big Picture, well, we're going to do something a little different. We did a listener survey on our website, got a large number of responses to that. And so we would like to talk about that and the future of the program, the things that you want to hear on the show and the way you'd like to hear it. And then Jim will go on the record about the nature of our firm, how we make decisions, how we handle individual clients, and why we're different than everybody else out there. I promise you, it'll be an interesting big picture that's a little different from the norm today. All of that coming up on the Financial Sense News Hour. So first, Ryan Poplava, the S&P 500 fell this week about 1.4%, and the bank stocks, it seemed, were actually hit the hardest. But taken into context, the S&P is only about 15 to 20 points below where President Trump spoke before Congress at the end of February, and only about 55 points off the all-time high. So in your opinion, good sir, what brought about the adjustment this week? I mean, was there an event, or is this just normal given how strong stocks have been in the U.S. since the elections?
Well, I think largely, John, the correction this week is, I think, mainly a natural phenomena based on, you know, what you said. The market had a nice move since the elections. And I mentioned last week that the calendar was probably going to be light given not a lot of major catalysts. The big economic numbers we'll see later on in the first week of April, that hard data for the month of March. And then we're expecting earnings sometime around mid-April, I think the 17th. And so we're going through a little bit of a slow period. There isn't any real major events that, you know, we really anticipated that could be possibly that driver, except for, like I mentioned last week, I think the healthcare bill, that was an unknown to see how the market would react, what would happen, would they pass it, would they not, would they fail, delay it, etc. So actually, you know, the market took, and looking at fiscal policy, given the healthcare bill was, in fact, not only delayed, but just scrapped on Friday after the market closed. The market wasn't able to react on that news, but they took it in stride. And I think that's because largely it has tempered some of the sentiment towards fiscal policy and what that's going to do. But there's a lot of patience there because everyone knows that this is going to be a long road to get towards that tax reform, towards deregulation and possibly eventually infrastructure, which we've priced out ourselves out all the way to the next year, not really seeing anything this year, just based on budgeting and how long it takes for things to get done. But let's look at the two major catalysts that have propelled the stock market higher, namely growth and fiscal policy expectations. On the growth side of the equation, the debate still stands between soft data versus hard data, and the gap really continues to stay fairly wide. Soft data are surveys and sentiment and checking in with CFOs. You know, what do you think's going on in your industry? I think it's doing this and this. That's soft data. And then there's finally the hard data, the stuff we can verify. Employment is at this percentage rate. This is, you know, how many jobs were lost this month? How many houses were sold this month, etc. That's all hard data. And there's been a gap between how great we feel about how the economy is doing and the sentiment surveys and then what the actual hard data is showing. Case in point, actually, this Friday, the Flash Purchasing Managers Index data was actually disappointing. The U.S. PMIs specifically fell a second month in a row, so far in March at 53.4. That's soft data with some elements of hard data in there, but mainly it's looked at as a kind of a soft data indication of the survey. So what do you think activity is? And a little bit of a drop there. So that's a little bit concerning. Still expanding. Anything above 50 is healthy. But, you know, here we are 2 months now that it's dipped a little bit. Then there's the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now forecast, which you could go to the Atlanta Fed's website and take a look at it. It's predicting around a 1% GDP growth rate for the first quarter. And most of the forecasts I've seen by economists have a consensus that's higher. So a bit of a gap there as well. So overall, things, they're well on the economy. They're steady. We had great earnings last quarter. They continue to be solid, especially in tech. And those are the areas in growth that are still there. Looking at fiscal policy, you know, just a boon to the market this Monday was the consensus that the populist tide has turned over there in Europe, given the French debate favored the more centered parties, the more centrists. So are there more countries with designs and plans to leave the EU? Is the EU breaking up? What does that do to currencies? Are we looking at francs? You know, I think when we look at the debate and when we look at the Denmark elections, it may be that the tide has turned and this, what we saw in Britain, is not going to be just a contagion throughout the rest of Europe. But, you know, who knows? Thing changed in the last hour of that vote in the UK. And then here, like I said, there were concerns over the healthcare bill that got delayed. And finally, you know, like I said, they scrapped it on Friday, despite strong encouragement from Trump. So if we look at the two pillars here in the US, that was growth economically, earnings, and then there's fiscal policy, what's going on there. Monetary policy, and we're not talking about too much. As I just mentioned last week, their plans for 3 rate hikes this year continues to be the base case, and that's continuing to be the case. So anyways, John, I think when we look at those two pillars, they're mainly in good conditions. Like I said, investors really have a lot of patience on the fiscal policy side, but definitely that sentiment has been tempered, and here we are trading sideways and slightly down from highs. So it makes sense.
I wouldn't count the whole populist movement as dead yet. It's going to be interesting to see what happens to Angela Merkel in Germany as the elections progress, because from what my friends in Germany are telling me, there's a lot more anger against her than the press would let on. So that's going to be, I think, the big election, but that's later this year. Okay, if the U.S. stock market's current valuations are based in good part on fiscal policy, now, why didn't we see a much bigger correction on Thursday when the House delayed the vote on repeal, replace of Obamacare, even though it was probably a good thing that they did that? This whole thing's being rushed, and it's questionable as to whether or not this is really addressing the issues that were raised by the original bill. But why didn't we see more of a reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, to be fair, we had the same problems with Democrats really pushing the Affordable Care Act rapidly without really taking a look. It was a very large document.
Right. That's what got us into this mess in the first place. They did it in just a couple
exactly.
of months. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So to be fair, you may be right. It may be a very good thing that actually the Republicans were held off on this and there's more minority discussion on it from here. Let's see. Definitely as things play out, I think, you know, the fiscal policy side, as I said, it's going to be an interesting year. But the consensus I'm hearing from analysts is that there's a lot more patience for tax reform. At the same time, saying investors can be patient, I don't see a whole lot of catalyst that can help stocks over the near term, given, you know, we've already heard from the Fed. It's the base case scenario, 3 rate hikes this year. We've heard better results from European elections are kind of shifting the story from the exit. But as you said, you know, what's going on in Germany, you know, it's not written on the wall. And just while economic numbers aren't screaming, they're also still mainly in the positive territory. So you've got all these sound bites of what's going on in the market, but the overall picture is still positive growth. Valuations aren't astronomical. And we had even Warren Buffett a while ago say it's not that expensive given where inflation is in the U.S. And I've actually heard that from a couple of CFAs that have come in through our office talking about, you know, the products they're trying to push, ETFs, et cetera, et cetera. So I've looked at some hard economic data recently that shows global exports are increasing. However, productivity and labor supply here in the U.S. has started trending down. And those are really good long-term indicators to follow for the business cycle. Maybe they're warning that there might be something there. And if we align a lot of this stuff together, we get the idea that maybe we are still, again, in that final phase of the bull market where corporate profits are peaking and we're at full employment. But we still stand on the assumption that we're not done. We're still in this bull phase. Things are still growing, at which point, you know, we're still positively allocated in our portfolios towards risk.
Chris Sheridan on FS Insider interviewed a few experts this week. One of those was Felix Sulauf, who said that they really anticipate chop here for the next like 6 to 8 weeks and then another attempt higher. And it's interesting because when Felix Sulauf was on in August speaking with Chris, that was last year, he anticipated a rally until spring. So far, he seems to be right on the market. So what should investors and traders be watching, say, next week for potential catalysts?
Yeah, we agree with him. You know, technically speaking, the market's overbought and is due for a little bit of reversion to the mean. No real catalysts on the tape, as I mentioned last week, that I think are really going to change the story. Some Fed speakers may influence the market tape next week. We've got Evans and a whole bunch of other speakers maybe shedding some light on what their anticipation is on where's that big topic that's going to be coming up, I think, in the future regarding Fed policy. It's going to be their balance sheet. What are the plans there? When do they plan to stop reinvesting and using the interest to buy more and continue to enlarge their balance sheet? And when that stops, when do they maybe start selling? You know, that'll be some concerns for us investing in fixed income because they're a pretty big buyer. They were at one point. So that could have a large effect on interest rates. And obviously, they don't want to put the cart before the horse. They've got to continue to see strong economic growth and then also checking to see what fiscal policy comes down and actually gets implemented. That will play a large part into their policies. So we'll hear from some speakers next week. I don't think at this point, though, that we're going to see anything revolutionary. On Wednesday, I'll be looking towards the UK because the story there is on Article 50. The UK's negotiations to leave the EU will really be formalized and will be formally triggered when they invoke that article. And the timeline will begin for a lot of estimates of how long it'll take for the UK to leave the EU, between 2 and 4 years that I've seen. But it's the start date. After that, most of the other stuff, I think, will have an effect mainly in April. You know, we'll get to see some fresh, hard data that first week. And then finally, first quarter earnings and a couple more French debates and finally the elections. So next month should be a little more interesting. But right now, yeah, a little bit of a dry spell. And like I said last week, that's typically when technicals really come to the forefront.
Okay, so it seems like it's going to be interesting again. And we're almost wrapping out March here right now. So we'll be the end of first quarter already. So first quarter earnings, as you've been talking about. Look forward to talking about it next week. Ryan Poplava, appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, John, just to put things in perspective, I just thought about this. We have actually gone the longest period since, I think, 1962 without having a 1% intraday move in the S&P 500. And, you know, taking everything into context, yes, we were down, what, 1.4% this week. But, you know, put that in context. Some people have called this the most peaceful market in many years.
Interesting. Good time to be in financial news, as I always say. So see you again next week.
Sounds good. See you then, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
According to a recent article, we see that house flipping is back and it's growing in popularity once again. Is this showing that we may be at another point where we saw in the housing market in 2005 with the market bubble? To discuss some of these things with us today is Rick Sharga of 10X. It's the largest online real estate marketplace in the world. Rick, would you mind just telling our audience your general outlook for the housing market, some of the trends that you're looking at, and what you see taking place?
Sure, Chris. Thanks for the opportunity today. We look at the housing market as being in the late stages of a recovery that started really back in about 2011, 2012 after the housing market bust. We're still not back to full recovery, which we would consider to be something like 6 million existing homes sold a year and between 750,000 and 800,000 new home sales. We'll probably end up this year marginally better than we did a year ago. We'll probably see somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.5 million existing homes sold, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 650,000 new homes. We would probably see more home sales, except that both existing homes and new homes are suffering from a lack of available inventory. And that lack of inventory is also driving up the price of homes that people are competing to buy. So while normally we would probably see somewhere in the neighborhood of a 4% year-over-year increase in prices, it looks like we might be in for another year of unusually high price increases, maybe between 6 and 7%.
Well, markets seem to be consolidating here. We had a big dip one day during the week, but markets seem to be inching their way back. Is this Trump rally over, or are we heading for a correction? Joining us on the program is Dan Witrubsky. Dan, let's begin with one of the oldest technical theories, the Dow theory, and that's the industrials and the transports. We've got the industrials hitting a new high. They've been pulling back. Transports have been going sideways. But I wonder, is this still a valid theory? I mean, the Dow industrials are not so much industrials anymore. You have technology companies in there. You have consumer product companies in there. And then also, if you look at the transports are not just trains and truckers anymore.
Yeah, it's certainly a good question. And it's something that I think, you know, not only market technicians, but market strategists, analysts have been dealing with and questioning for quite some time. I mean, you know, in my mind, from an investor perspective, what you have to do is boil it down to market breadth. You know, transports versus industrials, what that always said to me was not just two single metrics, you know, a nice stock trader's almanac tidbit to look at, but how are sectors participating in a market advance? In other words, you know, our transports, which back when that was invented, keep in mind, your biggest industries in the U.S. were industrials and transports. These were the biggest companies. And so what it spoke to back then, when perhaps, you know, it was valid, was that you had full participation of sectors as a whole to allow a healthy market advance. And you and I have talked about this in the past. You don't have one or two sectors or companies carrying the weight of the load in any market advance, but rather investors, and these days you consider it global investors, are buying the stock markets as an asset class, relative to other alternatives and choices. So, Jim, I think your point is a valid one. You know, it's probably not as significant as it used to be, but the theory that started it all, and that's market breadth and who is participating and how many of the sectors are participating, that's still very important. So we look at things, and I would suggest investors look at things this way. Instead of saying, hey, is it just the Dow industrials versus the Dow transports? You know, look at advanced decline. Look at market breadth. And in fact, you could look at the NYSE cumulative advanced decline. You can get this pretty much on any charting system. You can get it free on the internet. And what you want to look for, the same way you would look for in, you know, do the transports answer the industrials, you simply look at, does breadth confirm the price advance? So if the S&P 500 is what you want to use, or the NASDAQ 5000, or the Dow Jones, if those are making new highs, is breadth right along with it, you know, making new highs? In some instances, breadth will actually lead the tape, which is a very bullish sign. At other points, you'll see what we call divergence, negative divergence. You know, these benchmarks we watch and make new highs, but the breadth is really not answering. That's actually making lower highs. You know, it's not hitting the same milestones. Now, that negative divergence certainly, in my mind, is shot across the bow. And it speaks to, you know, the markets and the sectors are not fully participating in the current advance.
Yeah, so is that divergence, is that a warning in terms of what might transpire in the future?
You know, it certainly can be, but the question is a warning, you know, as to what? I mean, is it a warning to, you know, potential pullback or consolidation, or, you know, something far more sinister, right, which is the end of a bull market cycle? We've seen instances where it can be either, and I think you'd have to overlay some other analyses against it to really kind of construct the answer to that. I mean, in my opinion, you know, any divergence we see ahead, or some of the divergence we're seeing now, and we're seeing some modest divergence in the markets now. Some breadth is falling away a little bit. I don't see it as anything too significant. We're also seeing momentum indicators, you know, just things that measure price action. There's also some divergence there as well. And I think it does speak to some frothiness of the markets, perhaps are overheated on a short-term basis. We could see a pullback or sort of a consolidation period, but I don't necessarily at this stage look at it as the end of this cycle, certainly by a long shot, actually.
Well, as long as we're looking at old market adages and theories, we talked about the Dow theory, let's talk about another old adage in the market. That's the three steps and the stumble, the old Edson Gould. The Fed has now raised interest rates three times, and they're sticking to their game plan of two more to come this year. The futures market looks like we could get another hike as soon as maybe May or June, and maybe one towards the end of the year. So what about that? Is that pose a risk to the market as the Fed continues to raise rates?
Yeah, so that, I'm going to tell you, in my opinion, Jim, absolutely not. In fact, you want to see it. This, as we've talked about in the past, is a reflationary bull market cycle. This story and this cycle is all about reflating out of our prior bear market cycle, which was a function of a credit bubble and credit collapse, an asset market deflation. And what that did was push interest rates so historically below their mean that what we're seeing now is a simple reflation and reversion back to a normal interest rate environment. And so this is the cycle, the business cycle, the market cycle, righting itself after it was pushed to an extreme. And it's exactly what we want to see. And, you know, I will tell you that in the next few years, you're going to see the 10-year note go well north of 3%. So the big question is, can we get economic growth? Can we get multiple expansion against sorting a reflationary interest rate environment against a higher cost of capital? And the answer to that is that it is absolutely possible. In my opinion, it is probable. And that is simply because we have other factors driving this cycle, you know, demographics for one, valuation cycle, healthy credit markets, healthy demand on the credit side, the private sector in particular is another driver. And these things are really going to usurp that cost of capital. So, you know, the question is, can investors and traders get jittery over the short run trying to hedge what the Fed is going to do. Of course, you know, every bull market, every expansion period has its setback. Every bull market has corrections, and you use them as buying opportunity. But it's not going to negate that sort of rising tide that we see. And, you know, one of the key things with the Fed, and I always tell people this, if you want to really handicap what the Fed is going to do, take wages and divide it by the overall sort of inflation rate, the overall cost of things. And so you can do that. If you have a Bloomberg, you have other metrics, you can take wage rates and divide them by something, by the CPI, to get a ratio. And when you look at that line that it presents you over the last 30 or 40 years, you can see that the longer end of the curve has an extremely high correlation to that. So what are we seeing here? You know, we are seeing an economy that is slowly expanding. We are seeing labor participation that is improving, not just nationally, but really in the key demographic of the 25 to 55-year-old. That's our major consumer producer saver in this country. That labor participation rate is healthy and climbing. And wages, for the first time in decades, are starting to outpace modestly the cost of things. When wages outpace the cost of things, you're going to see that pull the Fed's policy higher. So no doubt we're going to continue to see the Fed move on this, and no doubt people are going to question it and question it and allow this to build a wall of worry. But no doubt this is exactly what is supposed to be happening. And again, I would suggest that you can see multiple expansion against that rising cost of capital. That's exactly the cycle we're in. So I am not concerned about it. In fact, I would be concerned if we stopped seeing that and the Fed took a different stance. You know, I would question where we are in my theory on the cycle. So that, to me, is all systems go still at this point. Again, you know, the way interest rates have based in the past after they've hit these ridiculously low levels, far below historical average, takes years. We've been in a base in interest rate for years. I think it's 7 or 8 years now. And the last time we made a secular base in interest rates, I think it took maybe 12, 13 years to complete itself. So we are still now in that base, but the bias is higher. And you're going to see, as this economic expansion continues and it pulls wages higher and it allows wages to outpace broader inflation, Fed's going to continue to raise. You may get some short-term noise and volatility off that as people get scared because we're not used to this regime. But to me, there are going to be tremendous buying opportunities.
So, Dan, if we are indeed in this reflationary cycle, and certainly if you take a look at some of the things that the Trump administration is proposing, tax cuts, infrastructure spending, a steepening yield curve, which would lend itself to credit creation, does that imply also that you're going to see sector rotation to go along with this? In other words, the things that would benefit from an inflationary or reflationary cycle. I'm thinking of things like materials, industrials, things like energy. Would you expect to see a rotation in that sector?
Yes. You know, in every bull market, in every cycle, you see rotation. And in fact, you know, when we look at the historical data, these prior bull market cycles and these expansion periods, at any given time, there was a different sector or, say, co-sectors sort of leading the charge. So I think that's normal and we should expect that. You can go about that two ways, well, I guess three ways, but, you know, traditionally two ways. You know, one is fundamental. And as you say, look at the administration, look at the policymakers, and bet sort of that way from fundamentals. Or you can do the more technical approach, which is to track money flow. I mean, right, all we're doing and all I do is track money flow underneath the surface of the tape. That is, where is money flowing into? Where is it flowing out of? And you take this from a very broad brushstroke in terms of global asset classes, you know, how is money rotating and flowing around the world, down into that sector level, and ultimately, you know, down into the stock level to populate a portfolio. So, you know, in looking at that, absolutely, we can see that. Now, you can use traditional sort of or historical data to say, well, if it's inflationary, you know, this, you know, A, B, and C should work. I'll start with that, but I won't necessarily hold fast to that. So you had mentioned something like materials, industrials. I'll go with you on industrials. I do believe we're going to stay with technology, healthcare. We're going to put the banks in there as well. I know the banks have had a rough couple of days within the last few sessions or so, or even moving into last week a little bit, and yet to date banks have been one of the best performers. But those would be my key groups this time right now for a time horizon of anywhere, you know, 6 months out to a year, maybe even, you know, longer, 18 months, 2 years or so. And then, you know, I generally think something will probably change. But just sort of being generic and then saying something like materials because it's inflationary or it's reflationary, you know, I'm not so sure that I would do that. Number one, I'm not seeing the money flow, you know, into the commodities complex. And that's another benchmark that I watch very closely. And believe it or not, that's as it should be. I want to make the distinction, and you and I have talked in the past, between, you know, what is reflationary and what is inflationary. You know, in an inflationary cycle, commodities work and commodities are leading the charge. We're not exactly in that cycle. And what you've seen and what we're going to continue to see is underperformance in general out of the commodity complex versus an asset class like the equity market. So I wouldn't necessarily put materials as one of my leading sectors at this moment. In fact, we're still an underweight of commodities because typically when we've looked at historical correlations between equities and commodities, there's a negative correlation between the two on a secular basis, secular meaning long term. And that negative correlation, it's just another fancy word for saying they're competing asset classes. One tends to outperform the different cycle against the other. And right now we're in a cycle that's going to continue to favor equities as an asset class over commodities in general. So what that's going to tell me is, yes, oil companies, oil stocks are in the S&P 500, material stocks are in the S&P or they're in the Dow, so on and so forth. But those as a sector, as stocks in terms of relative performance, I think are going to continue to lag. And, you know, again, on a relative basis, this is a rising tide. So I'm not looking for nominal price declines necessarily, but they're not going to be leading the charge because, again, this is an equity cycle, not necessarily a commodity one, in my opinion. So, again, sort of what I'm looking for, again, I would put industrials in there. I do think that's going to be a strong group. It has been. I would continue to look at banks and financials despite the setbacks that they've had over the last few sessions or the last couple of weeks. Technology is still there. You know, healthcare, biotechnology would be there as well. And eventually, as this secular bull market, this secular expansion ages, yeah, we're going to see rotation into other things. Again, fundamentals versus technicals, I tend to watch money flow. I haven't seen severe money flow changes yet that would warrant a major, you know, reallocation of sectors.
And finally, what about the international sector? We've seen a breakout in some of the ETFs like EFA and the EEM emerging market ETFs. What about international in this cycle?
Sure. It's risk on. Number one, this is a risk on cycle. It favors equities. So global investors are looking, again, we talked about this, equities as an asset class. And then from there, we drill down to see basically who's the prettiest girl at the dance. And for this, you know, we're going to, you know, look into some of the fundamentals. And quite frankly, you have emerging markets, some of the European markets, still at cheaper valuations than the U.S. I mean, in my mind, the U.S. is the story here. The U.S. and changes in the U.S. are sort of what's driving a global risk back on mentality underneath the surface. But because it's still mostly professional and institutional money managers that are driving this tape, that are really actively involved in this cycle, they are being selective. And so you're going to see, I think, you know, European shares, whether it's developed markets and a lot of the emerging markets, start to outperform. You know, the question is the duration of that outperformance. We look at things on a secular level, which is very long term, and we look at things, you know, shorter term on a cyclical level. So, you know, I think the rotation and the outperformance that I, you know, I'm looking for out of Europe, out of overseas markets, out of the emerging markets, and I do believe that's going to be more cyclical at this point, and eventually we'll see rotation where, you know, U.S. markets, I'm actually looking at small and mid caps in the U.S. to really eventually take a big leadership role around the world. Now, I don't know if that's right now. I mean, in my mind, you know, the markets do seem ripe for a bit of a pullback or at least a breather at this point. Again, I don't think it's the end of the cycle, but I don't know, and I'm not seeing necessarily at this point that there's that transition in leadership to U.S. small and mid-caps yet, but I do eventually see that as being a real theme that we're going to watch and then we're going to start tracking.
Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Sure, the best is just to reach out to me over email, dan.wontrowski@gmail.com. With any questions or color, I'd be happy to get back to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program. Well, we do call this program Lifetime Income because, well, as we retire, retired people are totally dependent upon their income from investments. And ever since we went through the great crash back in 2008 and the recession, the vast majority of investors have been putting their money into bond funds versus stock funds. Now, however, we see that the Fed is raising interest rates. And so what does this mean? We're going to talk about the complications of all of the money that has gone into bond funds now that the Fed's actually raising rates and what kind of a dilemma this creates.
You know, it was rather interesting. We follow fund flows, and especially after the Great Recession, because, you know, you think about it, John, people that were retiring in the last decade, they saw two bear markets, a major bear market in 2000 to 2002, and then it was repeated 5 years later from 2007 to 2009. So having gone through a bear market in stocks, where stocks went nowhere for 13 years, basically, and people lost anywhere from 40 to 50%, maybe even more if you were in tech stocks in the year 2000. So when the market began to recover in 2009 and the Fed announced quantitative easing, from 2009 to 2013, the first half of 2013, literally, I think it was $1.5 trillion went into bond funds for investors because the Fed brought interest rates down to zero. So if you were retired, what the heck did you do for income? Well, the inflation rate has been creeping up. A lot of that has to do with energy, but there has been some good news for consumers, at least on the ag side. Things have remained modest. Joining us on the program is Ned Schmidt. And Ned, I want to talk about what we've seen happen since the election of Donald Trump. The stock markets are up. We saw oil prices, at least until recently, were rising. But what's going on in the ag space? Because if you take a look at the ETF like DBA, it's been just going sideways for, gosh, you'd probably have to go back to last summer. And yet you have some of the, what we would call the ag type stocks like the John Deere's and some of those that are doing quite well. So what's going on in the ag sector?
The ag stocks have had a fantastic year. They're still up 18% from a year ago versus S&P at 14. But what's going on is two things. Revenues are driven by volumes and prices. And starting at the beginning of last year, U.S. grain exports exploded. In terms of the five major grains, corn, wheat, soybeans, rice, and sorghum, we're up about 25% from a year ago in export volumes. And some of the individual commodities export volumes are even stronger. I mean, corn export sales are still running over 60% ahead of last year. Soybean exports, which should be, right now they should be almost nothing. Export sales are up 80% from a year ago. And so we're selling all the grains we can ship.
If we are exporting more, meaning the market for our products is larger, why has that not contributed to higher prices? I'm looking at the corn ETF, and it's gone nowhere since going back to last summer.
Well, that's the point. You got to go back to last summer because it was in late summer, September, that most agri-commodities bottomed. The average agri-commodity, and I follow 18 of them, they're up 33% from their 52-week lows. And today, even after a grain sell-off, 10 of 18 are up more than 20% from their lows. So the lows were in basically August through October. My agri-food price index since October look bottom, is up over 30%. So that grain export was so strong that by late summer, it was starting to impact prices. And despite the sell-off in grains recently, we just reopened the Mississippi River a couple weeks ago, and our corn export volumes have exploded the last month. They're shipping corn down to Mississippi. It must be bumper-to-bumper barge traffic. And there's been some worry that Brazil, their harvest is in process. But the point is, we have cleared out so much grain in the United States that prices have to rise to get a farmer to sell it. Farmers in the United States are not anxious to sell grain right now because they're not getting the price they like. In Brazil, the Brazilian real, the Brazilian currency has been appreciating, and it's doubtful we're going to see much grain exports come out of Brazil because when the Brazilian currency appreciates, their farmers won't sell because they get a lower domestic price for their grain. So the grain situation, like soybeans, we have already exported. And remember, the USDA does not use calendar years, Jim. They use crop years. So the crop year for soybeans ends in August. We've already shipped or sold 98% of what they thought we would do all year. And so the grain exports are extremely strong. The other thing is meat products, animal proteins. Our beef exports are up over 30%. Our pork exports are up over 20%. There's a worldwide shortage of pork, largely because of China and the developing countries. If you listen to the news, all they talk about is China. But the fastest growing market for corn is sub-Saharan Africa. That's all the area of countries in Africa below the desert. The other fastest growing area is North Africa. And then you go to Vietnam and the Southeast Asia. It's the same thing in soybeans. Our fastest growing markets for soybeans are the developing nations, Southeast Asia and Africa. The developing nations are going to grow twice as fast as the developed nations. And with that income comes demand for meats. Our best customer, when I say our, I mean the U.S.'s best customer for chickens is Africa. And that market's going to grow dramatically. So when we talk about agriculture in the next 5 years, we're going to be talking about the incredible demand coming out of places like Vietnam, sub-Saharan Africa, Northern Africa. That's going to be the hotbed of growth. And their demand is pushing these things. Like U.S. beef, hanging beef, is up 30% in price from the lows. Pork prices are up 60% from this year's lows. And so we're seeing the prices come through dramatically. And it's because of global demand out of the developing nations. And, of course, the big customer is China. And China is moving our way. China has these giant inventories. And when you listen to people talk about global inventories of grains, and they go yada, yada, yada about Chinese inventories, they aren't any good. Last summer, China, which has the world's biggest corn reserves, held an auction to sell some of the reserves. Nobody came because you can't do anything with it. You can't feed them to an animal. You can't make it into human food. A reasonable guess is 25 to 50% of Chinese grain reserves are worthless. And that's why China has been changing their policy and lowering their prices. They used to pay farmers for how much they produce on a per bushel basis, or whatever they used metric basis. That was building all these reserves. And they said, this is nuts. We're going broke on this system. So now they have cut their payments to farmers, and they're going to let prices in China be set by the international market. So we're actually going to see in the next 2 or 3 years, Chinese imports of corn kick in because it's cheaper to buy and ship corn from the United States than it is to grow it in China. So we're seeing a complete change of policy there.
I'm looking at the livestock index, which has gone up over 30%. So what you're telling me, Ned, if corn's going up and these grains are going up, that's what farmers feed cattle and chickens. So if those prices are going up, then the price of raising chickens and cattle is going to go up as well. So that has got to show up somewhere down the road in inflation.
The rough part is that even if the price of chickens goes up, like they've gone up 40%, the markup by the retailers is so high. I mean, there's so much cost between the farmer's chicken price and the price at the retail store that, it one, it takes a long time to flow through, and two, it gets masked by all the other costs so that it doesn't flow through as dramatic into the CPI. Now, it will by the end of this year, because the costs are just going up. And, you know, I already mentioned we've got a shortage of pork on a worldwide basis. It looks like with the current round of bird flu, we're going to have a worldwide shortage of chickens develop. In the United States, in the southeastern part of the country, we've already killed over 200,000 chickens. You cannot move any poultry in the state of Kentucky. You can't load a truck with turkeys, chickens, ducks, or anything and move it in that state effective this week. China has a giant problem in that the bird flu is violent over there right now. Korea, South Korea, has a serious problem. Some of it's in Europe. Now, we're seeing two kinds, the normal kind of bird flu, and then a very viral strain. And the concern with that strain is, normally we move bird flu with wild birds. A duck flies over your chickens, and birds just mess wherever they are. They're flying along, they just go ahead and do it right there in the air. But we now think that it may be passed by the wind, which would be could have the potential to be a total catastrophe. Then we've had almost all nations blocking exports of Brazilian chickens, where South Korea got 80% of theirs. So we've got the potential to see perhaps a worldwide shortage of poultry develop sometime this year.
So what is this going to mean for consumers? Because when I go to the grocery store, I can't believe what the price of beef is. We've already seen it in seafood. If you're trying to buy salmon, the price of salmon, unless you're buying farm salmon, is just skyrocketed. So we're talking about higher food prices. Let's talk about what this means for investors in terms of the ag stocks. One of the things that we're seeing, whether it's seed companies, fertilizers, Ned, we're seeing a consolidation of the industry into fewer and fewer companies. I mean, you take two companies, Archer Daniels Midland and Bunge, and they control the shipment of the world's grain. So do you expect to see this further consolidation in the food industry?
Well, the thing with Archer Daniels and Bunge, let's separate them out from the consolidation. There are only four major players in the crop collection business. That's what they do. They collect crops, process them, and ship them. There's only four. They're ADM, BG, Louis Dreyfus, and Cargill. There's only two of them public. The other two are private. And so you've got to own them. The question is, when do you buy them? I mean, BG right now has moved so strongly. They surprised everybody and had two good quarters in a row. And this company hadn't put two good quarters in a row back-to-back for a long time. It's probably ahead of the game. Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, is a company that you need to own. It's the cheaper one of the two. It's got the most potential right now. But you do want to own at least one of those two stocks. Archer Daniels is interesting because this company used to be focused on the Midwestern United States, and they've been refocusing the company for a decade. They own 23% of Wilmar International, which is the biggest seller of palm oil to China. They've also expanded into China. They're opening some more fish feed plants because farmed fish is the only way China can satisfy demand for fish. Those two need to be in portfolios in some way. The problem with looking at the others is I don't have any cheap stocks anymore. Jim, these stocks have done so well over the last year that there's just not many cheap ones anymore. Agrium, which is AGU, which is the only fertilizer-related stock I've ever liked, and that's because it has the largest retail farm system in the world. They have these farm stores where they full service the farmer. Not only can you buy your fertilizers from them, but they have the technicians and the pro software to help the farmer figure out exactly what fertilizer he needs, exactly what herbicide, and so on. It's going to merge with potash in the third quarter. But fortunately, they're going to let AGU's management run the company. There is a growing positive tone in the talk about fertilizer companies because the situation is still such that nobody's going to build a fertilizer plant unless they absolutely have to have one. So we're going to see operating rate increase there. And I would rather buy an agrium and have the extra safety of the retail farm store operation than go out and chase a pure fertilizer play. The tractor stocks, I think, are clearly ahead of themselves. There's no doubt that the sales are going to be better this year than last year, but they are not going to go back to hefty years where farmers are trading tractors every year. We're not going to go there yet. So they're going to do well, but I think they're kind of overpriced at this point. But on the other hand, AGCO and Deere are the only two to own. And so maybe that's going to keep them at a premium. We are going to lose Monsanto this year, and we are going to lose Syngenta. So that money that was in those stocks to get exposure to ag has to go somewhere else. And so sometime this year when we get the Dow-DuPont merger done and the separation, there's going to be a lot of interest in that ag company that comes out of Dow-DuPont. That's going to be a company you want to own.
No, so if we were to sum up, taking a look at what's a lot of these ag stocks, like very much the rest of the market has been on a tear, especially since November. These stocks have really taken off. So there's not too many bargains here. So if you were an investor, would you wait for a pullback, Ned, given the fact that we're likely to see the one thing about ag products, every single year there are more people born in the world. So it's every year you have new consumers and mouths to feed. Would you wait for a pullback here?
They're already in process of that. Because we're going to get, Jim, on the 31st of this month, we get what's called a prospective planting report. And that's going to come out with lots of soybeans and less corn. But it's going to drive some people out of the future, commodity futures. So the price weakness in these stocks will probably be over by June or July. So it's not going to be a long correction. So people need to start getting familiar with the stocks. I would think any softening of this will be over by June, July. So unless the market collapses, then the next 3-4 months is the time to be watching.
Okay. So given that, maybe keep your powder dry, watch what unfolds in the market. And I guess what you're saying, Ed, given where grains are going as consumers, we're going to be paying more at the store in the future.
Yeah, you're going to see your favorite steaks are going to get more expensive, Jim. I assume you're still eating steaks.
I'm still eating steaks, Ned, but I may have to go vegetarian. But you're telling me grain prices are going up, too. So you can't win either way. Well, listen, my friend, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
The egg site is agrifoodvalueview.com.
One more time, Ned.
Agrifoodvalueview.com.
Moving on into the second hour of the program, coming up next, we have a special big picture. We're going to talk about all of the responses you people gave us to a survey we recently had online. And then Jim will go on the record answering many of your questions. All of this as the big picture arrives on the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com.